supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Yesterday, President Donald Trump unveiled a proposal for changing the country's tax code, and today, House Speaker Paul Ryan visited Delaware County to promote the plan, which includes several provisions altering how businesses are taxed. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports workers at the industrial manufacturing plant he toured wanted more details about how the plan will change their lives.
Inside a rust-colored building in Aston Township, the company Penn Machine turns out high-pressure piping used by gas and nuclear energy companies. In their opening remarks to employees, Speaker Ryan and local U.S. Congressman Pat Meehan echoed President Donald Trump's promise that the proposed tax changes will benefit the middle class.
This tax is not about the rich. It's about coming back and giving you a chance to put more money in your pocket.
The plan calls for reducing the number of individual tax brackets from 7 to 3 and has provisions for cutting corporate taxes and incentivizing businesses to locate in the U.S. Purchasing manager Gloria Mashinsky asked Ryan whether it'll make filing taxes simpler for workers who commute across state lines.
We have employees from 4 states that work here. Each state has different income tax structures. How would that be handled in the tax reform?
Well, we have basically a framework right now, and the framework says we got to simplify the tax code as much as possible.
A lot of how it would pare down the code is left up to Congress. Machinist Michael McGuire says with so much focus on the big picture promises, like cutting business taxes as a way to create jobs, he's not sure what the plan means for people like him.
You know, we all like money back in our pockets. We love that. But in the long term, how's it going to affect my kids? How's it going to affect me? So there's a lot of questions there.
He says he just hopes that Democrats and Republicans work together on changing the tax code so that it has a better shot of passing and making people's lives better. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court handed down a big decision today on education funding. It could eventually impact everything from textbooks to taxes, though there's a long way to go in the fair funding fight. Here to help us break it down is WHYY's Avi Wolfman. Aaron, and Avi, why are advocates in some districts upset about the state's school funding system?
Well, there's been this idea for a long time, Dave, that there is a big gap between rich and poor districts in Pennsylvania. And there's data that bears this out. You have a lot of districts that are really reliant on local taxes, right? And local taxes come from the value of property. And if your property doesn't have a lot of value, it's hard to raise money. And the state doesn't do a lot traditionally to even that out. And so, you know, when you talk to folks, even from rural school districts, small rural school districts, they're upset. And folks like Ed Alpert, who represents a lot of these school districts.
I'm telling you, folks, there are times where we just cannot compete because you have the haves and you have the have-nots, and we're on the side of the have-nots.
Oh, Avi, isn't it evened out to extent with the fair funding formula?
Right. So there is a new fair funding formula that evens it out somewhat, but they only push new money through that formula, and that's just a sliver of the total pot right now. So you still have a lot of the inequities that exist.
Who are the plaintiffs, and what are their contentions?
So in the lawsuit, the plaintiffs are a handful of school districts and parents in those school districts, kids in those school districts, and a couple of advocacy groups. And what they're saying is, look, there's a constitutional guarantee in Pennsylvania to a thorough and efficient system of public education. Thorough and efficient. And what they're saying is, hey, the legislature's not doing that. It's not thorough and efficient. And the courts have to intervene here, put a stop to this. And just to put a little finer point on it, today was just the first step in that, in trying to get to that argument, but it was a big step.
So let's look at that step. Help us make sense of today's Supreme Court finding.
So what the Supreme Court did, which is what they'd never done before, twice they'd failed to do this in prior cases, is they said, we're going to look at this. We're going to look at this issue, okay? Because in the past, what they had said is, we don't want to infringe here. Doling out money, that's the legislature's duty, okay? So we're not going to touch it. It's too tricky. It's a slippery slope. We'll get mired down in all sorts of logistics about what's fair and what's thorough and what's efficient. We're not going to do that. This Supreme Court said, no, we have a constitutional duty here to make sure that the laws, the way that they're processed and executed, comport with what's in the Constitution. So we're going to take a look at this. And so that's where we're headed next.
So call it a slippery slope or a second step. What's next?
So the second step is that basically this goes back to the trial court, because it's going to go back to the Commonwealth Court. And they're going to actually look at the merits of the case. They're going to look at the funding in Pennsylvania, and they're going to say, hey, is this actually thorough and efficient? And now they're not concerned anymore whether they can get into this issue. They're in it now. They're going to look at the merits, and of course, then there could be appeals after that. And sort of down the road, if the courts say, hey, this isn't thorough and efficient, we could have all sorts of changes in Pennsylvania. We could have more money from the legislature, right? It could be doled out differently based on whatever the courts say. And there are states, New Jersey's one of them, where the courts have gotten in and say, this isn't working. This isn't constitutional. You got to change it up. And that creates huge ripple effects for how money is doled out. In New Jersey, for instance, more money goes to some big urban school districts, poorer school districts like Newark and Patterson and Camden. And that's been going on for decades. And could we see a system like that in Pennsylvania? Maybe. It all depends on this is all state specific, but it depends on what the justices say. And now we're going to actually have that argument. And advocates are really excited about that.
Avi, thanks for helping us make sense of this first ripple.
Thanks so much, Dave.
WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt on NewsWorks Tonight. It's been a tough week for many of the 120,000 Puerto Rican Philadelphians. Many families here still haven't been able to get in touch with their relatives on the island after the devastation of Hurricane Maria. And the anxiety of being without contact can be overwhelming. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Anne Hoffman has more on what families can do to cope.
Alicia Miranda was born in Puerto Rico and now lives in South Philadelphia. She hasn't been able to reach several of her family members on the island, and it's starting to take a toll on her.
It's just really hard to concentrate. I'm just trying to stay strong, but if I think about it for too much, it's really hard.
Miranda says she's making mistakes at work, and in every free moment, she's checking social media for updates.
I hear the same story from each one of my clients.
That's therapist Margarita Graber. She works at Hispanic Counseling Services in North Philly. She's telling her clients to get in touch with the Red Cross and trying her best to comfort them. But Graber is also realistic that things are tough right now in Puerto Rico. Her sister just asked her to send a generator because it may take 4 to 6 months to get electricity back. Christian Jordel is a therapist who specializes in family counseling. He says people on the mainland are experiencing vicarious trauma.
This is not just happening to people who are in Puerto Rico, but anyone who identifies themselves as Puerto Rican, there's always that connection.
But Jordal says that for some people, fundraising or direct service could be a good way to deal with the uncertainty.
That's a way in which they're turning their anxiety into sort of action in a way that helps them at least sort of have an outlet.
For instance, Graber plans to go to the Toa Alta region of Puerto Rico to volunteer her services as a therapist. And Miranda is channeling her anger at the federal government's slow relief efforts by helping to collect emergency supplies. Jordal also recommends that parents give each other time to process their feelings by taking turns doing childcare. And he says it's okay to take breaks from the news and social media. Anne Hoffman, WHYY News.
The candidate who prevails at the polls in November to succeed Chris Christie will be urged to consider advancing sound, science-informed climate change policy in New Jersey, opportunities for the next governor. That plan, published in a letter yesterday, was compiled by 24 state leaders, including former Governor Jim Florio, who joins me now to explain. Governor Florio, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
It's my pleasure. I'm happy to be here with you.
Now, it's an opportunity for the next governor, but this letter is also written with the public in mind. Explain.
Well, I think what we're trying to do is lift the level of awareness of the public to the significance of the problems associated with climate change for New Jersey. And that way, the public will weigh in terms of not only the direction that they give to the governor, but also who is going to be the governor. These are problems that face our state that are very serious.
You were certainly known in your capacity in Congress prior to becoming governor as the author of the 1980 Superfund legislation. Is the political climate very different now in terms of getting that kind of effort signed into law?
Well, unfortunately, the answer is yes. Washington has become very insensitive to environmental concerns. But that all the more makes it that important that we have state action to fill in the void when the federal government walks away. The administration in Washington won't even concede that climate change is real. They've rejected scientific evidence, and that's tragic.
Governor, the recommendations in this letter are broken down in terms of immediate, mid-range, and long-range. What are some obvious fixes that can be done right off the bat?
Well, I think one of the first things we should do is reverse the policy in the state that took New Jersey out of the regional greenhouse gas initiative. That's something called REGGI that tried to put some limitations on power companies' emissions. New Jersey was a member. In this last couple of years, we were taken out of it. We should go back in and be able to use that regulatory authority to cut down on emissions out of utilities and also generate revenues.
Let's note that you were instrumental decades ago in shaping legislation establishing the New Jersey Pinelands National Reserve and then more recently served as chair of its commission. What's the status of the Pinelands currently?
Unfortunately, that too in the last couple of years has suffered. They've just approved putting two gas pipelines through the most fragile areas in the Pinelands. The significance of that is that the Pinelands, which is about 20% of New Jersey, sits on top of the largest freshwater aquifer. That's the drinking water source for most of the people in South Jersey. If you have pipeline breaks, which happen from time to time, you could very well destroy the opportunity to get fresh water for substantial numbers of people. I'm hopeful with a change of administration, there'll be a reversal of some of these things, and we'll go back to appreciating the importance of the Pinelands to be preserved.
You've already alluded quite strongly that leadership and courage is not forthcoming at the federal level in the current administration. Do you think Phil Murphy or Kim Quadano can exert that kind of leadership and moxie?
I think traditionally New Jersey has been in the forefront of environmental protection. We were really there before the federal government was in many of these different areas. We need to get back to that, and if we do get back to that, we can really show the way. New Jersey is one of only two elections statewide in the nation, and therefore, if you're not happy with what's going on in Washington now, New Jersey has an opportunity to philosophically reverse what's going on in Washington and show the way for the government of all the states to come back, and for the federal government to also be changing direction.
You've said that New Jersey has been in the vanguard in this regard. How would you rate Chris Christie on that continuum?
Well, I think the last couple of years have been not as sensitive as they could be. For example, 7 years ago, the administration agreed to put into place law to provide for offshore wind turbines. Generation of clean energy would be particularly advantageous for New Jersey. 7 years later, the law has not been implemented. That's not something that indicates a lot of sensitivity.
Governor Florio, it sounds as if you are as busy out of office as you were when you were in it. Thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure. Lots of good luck.
New Jersey Governor Jim Florio, one of the authors of the plan entitled Advancing Sound, Science-Informed Climate Change Policy in New Jersey, Opportunities for the Next Governor. More Americans are renting homes now than at any point since 1965, and that trend is especially true in New Jersey, where a high cost of living and rising property taxes have dashed the hopes of many aspiring homeowners. In the latest installment of our statewide series on the New Jersey governor's race, Voting Block, we take a look at why home ownership is on the decline and what can be done about it at the state level. Let's return to the South Jersey town of Paulsboro, where a long tradition of home ownership is starting to fade. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
Betty Paulson lives on a quiet block in the outskirts of Paulsboro, a small town just across the Delaware River from the Philly airport. She's owned a home here with her husband for 15 years. Paulson says all of her neighbors used to be homeowners, but not anymore.
And they've passed and moved on. And so that's what we've seen, a lot of people that have their houses have gone up for sale or they couldn't sell them, so they have renters in them.
renters. Lately, it's the top issue in Paulsboro. Residents complain there's been a recent influx of renters who have given the town a rougher edge and that abandoned homes are falling into disrepair. Community meetings are filled with residents like Paulson, who say the drop-off in home ownership is a big change for Paulsboro. In the background, her dog Pepper barks at a jogger.
You could tell who, you know, like you'll see a sign in the window that the property's up for sale or whatever, and, you know, they don't keep their properties as nice as a homeowner. They don't have that investment.
Renting is on the upswing not only in Paulsboro but across New Jersey. Although the Garden State has household incomes about 30% above the national average, its housing prices are about 50% higher, which means even some people who work full-time jobs can't afford to buy a house. James Hughes is a professor at Rutgers University's Blaustein School.
So this is one of the aftershocks, I think, of the Great Recession, is that homeownership has lost some of its allure.
Hughes says homeownership used to be seen as the, quote, super piggy bank, a great investment for young people. But now many people can't afford to make that investment at all. Pew estimates that more Americans are renting now than at any point in the last 50 years. In New Jersey, there are challenges for renters. Prices can be high, and it can be hard to find a place to rent, especially in the suburbs the state is known for. In fact, New Jersey had a long history of struggling to provide affordable housing for low-income people until two court decisions made it mandatory for towns to do so. The state agency overseeing affordable housing folded in 2015, so now state courts decide how much affordable housing towns have to provide, whether they want to or not. Kevin Walsh runs the nonprofit Fair Share Housing Center in Cherry Hill.
Lots of municipalities love to have malls and office parks, but they don't necessarily provide the kind of zoning that's needed to develop starter homes and apartments for lower-income households who work in the malls and office parks.
For example, if a town were only zoning for single-family homes, only single-family homes would get built. Poor people who could only afford to, say, rent a small apartment would be priced out of living in that town altogether. Walsh says many of the public officials who resisted affordable housing simply don't realize how many residents are actually struggling to pay for a place to live.
You know, in one instance, we had a mayor that fought for years and years and years. And then when new affordable homes were built in the mayor's town, the mayor asked if his secretary could apply.
Governor Chris Christie failed to set guidelines for affordable housing while he was in office, leading the state court system to take over the process. But come January, a new governor will have to deal with the state's housing issues. Lieutenant Governor Kim Guadagno, the Republican candidate, calls the current state of affordable housing requirements unworkable. And she's staking her campaign on a promise to lower property taxes, a perennial issue in New Jersey, which she says will help younger people and seniors afford homes. Democrat Phil Murphy, a former Goldman Sachs executive, supports a tax credit for businesses that invest in distressed neighborhoods and says new housing will follow. He's also promising to cut property taxes. But even for people who can afford to buy homes, Hughes, the Rutgers professor, says they aren't choosing small blue-collar towns like Paulsboro.
The millennials' parents, that is baby boomers, couldn't wait to get out of New Jersey's cities and move to the leafy suburbs. In contrast, millennials can't wait to get out of the leafy suburbs and move to 24/7 active environments.
New buyers are skipping Paulsboro, longtime homeowners are passing away, and others unable to afford rising costs are facing foreclosure. All of that is hurting Paulsboro and dozens of other small towns across New Jersey trying to attract new buyers and fend off neighborhood blight. In Paulsboro, that means the only code enforcement official is issuing more violations. And the two-square-mile town now has a list of abandoned properties on its website, hoping to take legal control of those homes and flip them. But Mayor Gary Stevenson says what Paulsboro really needs is money. He says when the state government doles out municipal funding, lawmakers tend to forget about towns like his.
They keep shifting a lot of money to your Camdens and your Newarks, and they keep forgetting about the little towns. Like, we don't make up enough.
Stevenson hopes New Jersey's next governor realizes that those housing issues that dog big cities also impact the state's many small towns. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Finally this evening, Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney is on national TV. Though he's not talking policy, he's stuffing his face. Kenney, along with several other real-life mayors from around the country, was featured in a promo for the new ABC series, The Mayor. The spot shows the fictional rapper and newly elected mayor of his California hometown, Courtney Jones, calling up a bevy of mayors to ask their advice and get a few pointers from the pros. Well, when he asks Kenny about eating on the job, Kenny, mid-bite with what one can only hope is a cheesesteak, replies,
"Absolutely not."
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.